The point at which we stopped, the point at which we stopped was when you were on the bargaining committee, they had formally made someone a lead of your crew.
Mm-hmm, that's correct.
And it was right before the strike. And one of the things I was wondering was, it sounded like most of your work was really union work.
It was.
How much time a day would you, at that point, say right before the strike in early 51, would you be with your crew on the job?
Very, very little. Just check in. In other words, I would have to give you see, we were required to go out and punch in our regular area and check in and report to our work area.
Mm-hmm.
And then if there was union activity scheduled, I would just immediately sign out on a union time charge and proceed with my business. So, naturally negotiations, it was just a full-time thing.
Yeah. And you were called lead, though.
Oh, yes.
Your company classification.
Oh, yeah. Even in an article in the paper here, they referred to me as lead.
Uh-huh.
You know, my classification here.
But you would be still fully paid by the company.
That's right.
And the charge against the union was not a charge, literally, but more as when they figured the cost of the plane or whatever.
That's correct. That's correct. Uh-huh.
I see. Okay. Uh-huh. I just needed to
yes,
clarify that.
That's right. Now, if we should say, for instance, during the 8-hour schedule during the day, if the command, you know, at 7 o'clock and punch in and they immediately go up to negotiations. And supposing we worked just the 4 hours, and then we had to adjourn to go to the union hall for regrouping or whatever, then the union would pay for the time out of the plant. Whatever time was in the plant, or whatever time we were clocked in, the company contractually was obligated to pay. You see?
Now, at what point, because one of the things you talked about was, obviously, when you know a contract's about to come up, at least 6 months or so before,
oh, yes.
What might be the strike and the expiration of the contract to begin negotiations. At what point, do you recall, in 51, would those discussions have begun?
Well, we had a formal agreement in the contract that you must be open 45 days prior to.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a contractual. But we would start 6 months before,
mm-hmm.
and we would start talking to them about the job inequities and things that we felt that we should improve upon and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and give them just basically an idea, see if we couldn't come. But then 45 days prior to, then we present our formal demands to the company. We exchanged proposals.
Mm-hmm. I see.
45 days prior to.
But up until this time, you were spending most of your time in discussions with them.
Right. Besides handling your everyday business of grievances and arbitration cases and that sort of thing.
Now, who was on the at that point? Who was on the bargaining committee with you? Do you recall?
Yes, yes. Bill Stockton was the chairman, and let me see. Bill Stockton. I can't remember all. Bill Stockton, Bill Barnes, Gene Finan. Oh, dear. I can't think of all their names.
You mentioned before there were seven of you, though.
Yes, that's correct.
And
that's
you
correct.
You were the only woman on the bargaining.
Yes. I was the first one that was ever elected. I'll turn this off. I was the first one elected to the bargaining committee, first female ever elected. Yes.
Now, Strzok, before we get into it, I wonder if we can go over a little bit of what the structure was. The union, the bargaining committee was... Where did that stand in relationship to the union, the local?
The structure?
Structure and authority.
Well, the executive board, of course, is your main body, you know, policy-making body. Then after that, then your bargaining committee. And, however, the bargaining committee does all of your negotiating. The only member of the executive board that might take part in it would be the president of the local,
mm-hmm.
you see. And so, however, once the... the whole program been set up, and before you even present it to the company, your executive board has to approve it. You know, has to review it and approve it. And then the bargaining committee goes in and negotiates, but they're the ones that have the full power, I mean, to do the negotiating, but not they can't do anything without the approval of the executive board, and of course, in turn, then, of course, the membership is the top authority. Membership's top authority.
Was the chairman of the bargaining committee a member of the executive board?
No.
So there was no direct tie between membership on the bargaining committee and the executive
board? No.
Uh-huh.
Alex Grew was on the committee also.
And did each of you have different roles, or did you function as a total committee?
Well, usually what we did to expedite, we would assign certain parts of the contract to certain parts to certain committee men, and for reevaluation of jobs to certain people too.
Mm.
So that way, you know, each one of us would have our own assignment, job assignment.
Mm-hmm. And what
was your assignment? Well, mine was I had to do a lot with writing and rewriting job descriptions, creating and correcting and bringing them up to date, you know, according to the machinery and the operations we had in the plant,
mm-hmm.
Job descriptions and also the seniority agreement, clause of the seniority agreement in the contract. I was assigned to that, and one of the big things was the job description of the lead classification,
mm-hmm.
which has kind of fallen by the wayside after all these years. They're trying to, St. Louis doesn't have any more leads at all, and they've been breaking back the leads in Long Beach and not replacing, so we still have the same problem in Long Beach right now,
mm-hmm.
that we're sweating out negotiations
mm-hmm.
presently.
And what was the issue there about the lead classification?
The lead classification was that we had a lot of our administrative people who would come up through the ranks and had difficulty in realizing that they were administrative people, and they'd step back and do some of the bargaining unit work that was described, you know, in a job description as being bargaining unit work that had been approved of and everything else by the National Labor Relations Board, et cetera, et cetera. So we had to write a very clear definition of what a lead person, you know, what their functions were.
Mm-hmm.
And that lead person would be a senior person, you know, in the whole classification within the occupation,
mm-hmm.
that would lead that crew, and exactly what those duties would be, so there wouldn't be any problem
mm-hmm.
of just what does a lead man do or what does a supervisor do.
So it seemed to be a problem, the confusion of there being in a kind of quasi-management position almost.
Yes, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. And the way the description was worded, too, there were some things that really and truly would be partly management and partly hourly. So we had to try to get it, you know, straightened out as
mm-hmm.
best we could.
Mm-hmm.
And the job description hasn't been changed since then. However, it can be improved upon, needless to say.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're having problems with that like right now, like 1980. We're having lots of problems.
Were there any, in this period leading up to the strike, when the issues were being discussed and examined, what were some of the key issues that seemed to be the problem areas in preparation for renegotiation?
Well, of course, we had maintenance of membership and checkoff, and we were after a union shop. We wanted a union shop, naturally. And we had been negotiating without a contract for so many months, we were asking for retroactivity as far as the settlement of the contract is concerned. And we did not have a pension plan. We were asking for a pension plan. We had sick leave, but it was you had to be there 5 years before you could qualify. So we're asking for 1 year, you know, 1 year. And we were asking for the cost of living escalation clause. We didn't have that then in 1951. And it was called, you know, and we're asking for severance pay also.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, let's see, we were asking for a 10% wage increase. And also, we were asking for overtime pay for Saturday, which we weren't getting then in 1951. We weren't getting overtime pay for Saturday. Saturday is such a call, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And then we asked for two more extra paid holidays. And, you know, we used to be permitted to post our bulletins on the union bulletin boards. But before we did, the company had to scrutinize and okay every one of them, and they got to the point where they even took that right away from us posting them right before the strike because they didn't like us to have the control of just running up on our bicycle and putting something on the board, you know. So we asked to have the right to post our bulletins without censorship,
mm-hmm.
you know. And let's see here. Well, of course, we're asking for a 10% wage increase.
Mm-hmm.
But and believe it or not, we were still fighting for this, the right to smoke on the job. This is ridiculous.
Because you talked last time about the grievances that were
Oh, it was just
smoking.
Ridiculous, you know. There's so many grievances, and at that time you take your grievances. The grievances are heard in the order in which they're filed, with the exception of discharge cases, and of course they have priority. And your docket could be so, you could have 2 pages just flooded with these nuisance grievances when you had some things on your classification grievance that a person was losing money on their shop there that, you know, you'd want to get to, but much, much more important. So that was another one. That was a nuisance thing.
Now, among all these issues, for instance, on sick leave, were there any of what today we would call women's issues, like around maternity, or any of those kinds of issues relating more to women?
No, we did not particularly have the problem there. We had we had maternity benefits,
mm-hmm.
and at this particular time, in 1951, we had insurance, but we had to pay for all of it ourselves. In 1951, we were asking the company to contribute $3.50 a month towards our insurance.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first contribution, you might say, you know, say. And also that we would have the right to help select the carrier.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have that right before.
Hmm.
No.
Even though you were paying the bulk of it.
Yes, that's right. We had to negotiate those things.
I see.
They just made it part of the bargaining package, and, you know, it was one we wanted very much,
mm-hmm.
and so it was just something that they figured out fine. You know, trade something for that.
No, and were maternity benefits covered under that?
Oh yes, but I don't recall how much because you know, I mean, it was just a portion.
Mm-hmm.
We even had to negotiate those benefits over the years. I mean, like whether it was $25 or $50, mm-hmm. or 50%, and then finally total coverage. You know, see.
And how about maternity leave? Would a woman be able to come back with priority?
Oh yes. Oh yes. Oh, yes, you'd have pregnancy leave. Uh-huh. We had that. Child return, I believe it was within 30 days after,
mm-hmm.
you know, after delivery.
Now, Betty, at this point, the pre-strike period preparing, beginning the discussions about all of these issues, what was your own family and social life like? Had your daughter yet married? Or
no,
she
was still home.
She was still home. How old would she have been at that point, in 51?
Let me see. Let me figure real quick here.
She was 16.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was in high school.
Oh, yeah, she was in high school.
Uh-huh. And your father was still...
Yes, my father was still alive.
Uh-huh.
So it was my father and I and my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a house that we bought during the war, you know,
mm-hmm.
we were living in. So my father, his income, of course, was a retired check, you know, retired
mm-hmm.
government check, which was not a whole lot. And so when we hit the bricks, there was no income except what my dad had, and that didn't cover all of our expenses, needless to say.
Mm.
And so it was that was one of the tough things for everybody that when we hit the bricks. You know, a lot of the people had been. Just struggling. A little BSM has been struggling for a long time, not being able to make their,
mm-hmm.
not being able to buy the things that people really needed. That's why they went on strike,
mm-hmm.
you see, because they just couldn't live under those conditions.
Yeah.
And so we had to set up our own strike assistance program.
Mm-hmm.
And so we met with the executive board, and we set up a program. We said, you know, we decided that so much for each person and so much for each child, and that's what we'd have to set up to give them as far as subsistence was concerned.
Now, was this set up in advance of actually going out?
Not for about a week before.
Mm-hmm.
We got right down to the very last before we set up, you know, the procedures and the allowances for each family.
Mm-hmm.
And however, we started, good month, 6 weeks before, we had our community services committee set up, so we'd have four or five people that would handle all of banks, you know, bank loans and that sort of thing, and then we'd have a rent committee, and we'd have a committee that would take care of nothing but rents for whatever, you know, bank payments or landlords or whatever, and then we even had one loan. I forget which loan department it was, but there was some place that would grant loans. You know, we'd have a man that would take care of that,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then we had one committee that would take care of people who had. Contracts with like Sears and Roebuck or some other department stores, so we could call them and make arrangements to extend their
as you were preparing
to grant them, you know.
Again, before you actually went out, as you were preparing these sorts of things, what sort of reactions would you get from the community as you sought assistance in preparation for what was going to happen?
Well, when we started out, it was very good. We really found out, you know, that like Sears and Roebuck, they realized that our people were having a hard time getting along. They were having a hard time paying their bills, you know, and so we had very good relationship with people like Sears and Roebuck and, well, the Gas and Light Company, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. And some of the other big, was Montgomery Wards. Mm-hmm. And I think now one department store wasn't too cooperative, you know, Buffum's. But the people that dealt with the working people every day, we had very good luck. Excellent. We had a problem where a lot of people were living in the housing projects. Mm-hmm. And which was subsidized by the government. And that was kind of a problem for a while because the managing people there said, well, that they would consider extending, you know, credit to those people who had tried to keep their rents up, but those who were chronic, mm-hmm. you know, backsliders, why they're going to have to put them out in the street. Mm-hmm. So we had a heck of a time, and we got into that with some of the government people, and of course they said that, we told them, I said, well, you know, if you put the people out on strike, they're going to have to go back to work, and that's, in a sense, strike breaking, you know. And they said, well, they were not in the business of breaking any strikes. They had nothing to do with that, so they would extend. Uh-huh. So they extended the rents and extended, you know, their credit and that sort uh-huh. of thing. In some cases where we had people who were really in arrears, you know, a couple of 2 or 3 months, we would pay 1 month maybe, mm. say, and get them to agree to wait. You know, we'd say, look, we're expecting to go back to work. We didn't want to be on strike, and we didn't, you know. Uh-huh. And so they went along with that. Then we'd finally have to get to maybe then after that month, and maybe we'd have to give them 2 weeks mm-hmm. rent. And all of that came out of the, from the UAW CIO. We did not have a strike fund.
From the international. Tell me a little about going to this convention. The convention was...
Oh, that was very important. Mm-hmm. That was earlier. I can't remember the exact month, but it was earlier in 1951. Mm-hmm. I think it was June or something like mm-hmm. that. Anyway, we heard, you know, that we heard a rumble that they were going to raise our dues a dollar. Well, my gosh, we were hearing so bad out here and everything else that just even mention a dollar increase in dues would just, our people would just fall apart. So we didn't even take to the membership here. Well, when we got back there, you know, I was chairman of the delegation.
Now, tell me how you managed to get elected to the delegation, how many people went and how you got elected.
I believe there were 5 people to the delegation, mm-hmm. in the delegation, and this was not the first convention that I ever attended. And, you know, usually what you do, you, amongst yourselves, you decide who's going to run. Well, there was no pre-caucusing to it, and particularly... I had just been very active, you know, and with the fellows and everything else, and they accepted me and, you know, and all that sort of thing. And they said, well, Betty, we'd like to have you be chairman of the convention. I said, well, okay, fine. And when I got back there, you know, I had become quite acquainted with some of the top leadership and everything else, and I was a great admirer of Walter Ruther, you know. And I had the honor, you know, of putting his name in nomination for president, too, which was a big thrill. But I had talked to our president before I left here, and I told him that, you know, I said, now, you know, Oval, please, I hope that the executive board is not considering sending us back instructed should this dollar dues increase happen. Because if it does, you know, if you send me back, you know, instructed to vote against it, then I won't feel, I might not be able to get the backing of the convention on strike assistance. So he and I worked it out, whereby we were not sent back instructed, okay? When we got back there, the day that, the dues increase came up first. Mm-hmm. Well, fortunately, we got it through, and we voted for it. We voted for it amongst ourselves, you know, the people, the delegates in my group voted. We voted to support it. That afternoon, this was in the morning, I received a telegram instructing us to vote against it. It was too late. That very afternoon, I took the floor, and I asked, we get a report on our strike at Douglas, whether we impending strike and all that sort of thing. I said, should we go on strike, I would like to ask the support of this convention for financial assistance, because without that, we can't possibly make it, you know. They voted unanimously to support it, financially. Mm-hmm. And there was no mechanism set up at all or anything like mm-hmm. that. There was nothing at all, you know. So that went over. So you see, everything worked out beautifully for us, mm-hmm. beautifully for us. And when we came back to the local, of course, they didn't chastise me for our group for voting for the dues increase, because we felt we had to do that in order to get support from the convention. Mm-hmm. And we were not instructed at that time, and a telegram arrived late.
Tell me a little bit about you said you've gone to a convention previously. I'm wondering, very often union women, particularly in those days, had a lot of problems at the convention with the men bothering them. What was it like for you as a woman at the convention?
Well,
in the hotel and going to the meetings, etc.
You know, I never had any problem.
Mm-hmm.
I really didn't. Maybe it's because of the way, you know, I conducted myself from way back and being a mother and, you know, a parent raising my child. And I didn't chase around or a lot of that stuff like that. When I saw someone and fell in love, I got married, you know. You know, which is kind of, I wouldn't do that now. Somebody, no way, you know, but I did. Anyway, so I always conducted myself on that level. And not that I wouldn't have a drink with the fellows and things like that. But they respected me.
Mm-hmm.
They really did. I didn't have any problems in the hotels and chasing or anything like that. They'd ask to come over and have a drink or something like that, you know. And I'm not saying that I didn't have I know they're asking me over for a drink, but they had in mind. But I kept it in that level,
mm-hmm.
you know. I never had any problem.
Mm-hmm.
And, now, of course, I suspected when the fellows elected me chairman of the delegation this time, one of the reasons was because the fellows like to go off and party and see the sights or whatever, and the chairman delegation is the one that has to cast the votes, you know, like in a block, whatever you may have. And so later on I told him, I said, hey guys, you know, here I am so flattered that you're electing me chairman. I said, and I look at the attendance record here and I can see why. I don't know if I should be flattered or not. But they were all okay. I really didn't have any problems.
Now, who would you room with at the convention? Would it be a woman from another vocal, or would you have your
not
own?
Have my
we were talking about the rooming situation.
Oh, yes,
at the convention.
Yes. I roomed alone, mm-hmm. but there were times I roomed with other girls, other delegates, you know.
Other unions?
Yes, other unions, uh-huh, other unions. Uh-huh.
Well, at that point, at the 51 convention, what was your relationship like to women from other locals around the country?
Did I was becoming acquainted with them.
Mm-hmm.
There weren't very many.
Mm-hmm.
And however, I was becoming acquainted with them, and you know, it was just really very interesting. And I'd make it a point
mm-hmm.
to meet with some of the girls.
What sort of mechanism was there for the women to get together and talk? Was there any?
No, there weren't any committees. We not got set up.
Mm-hmm.
Not like there are now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have regular caucuses set up.
Mm-hmm.
And, but we were just, we were unique in the labor movement, and find some gal elected, you're going to seek her out, you know,
mm-hmm.
and compare notes as to what conditions were in your plant and, you know, that sort of thing. And contracts, we're interested in contracts,
mm-hmm.
contractual gains, and, of course, our own political lives, too,
mm-hmm.
you know.
So by the 51 election, would you talk with other women about how as women
yes.
their positions were like in the union?
Oh, yes.
And what was the general feeling of all of you at that point in terms of your own treatment in the union?
Well, it was our own treatment. As far as our UAW contracts were concerned, we were covered pretty well. I mean, we didn't suffer too much because it was equal pay for equal work, you know, and we're all covered in the seniority agreement,
mm-hmm.
and we had maternity clauses in the contract and that sort of thing, you know. And as far as discrimination is concerned and that sort of thing, we had the seniority agreement, and if you had the seniority to put you up in a position to bid for the job or
mm-hmm.
apply for the job, you know, if you had the ability, fine, no problem, you got it.
Mm-hmm. And how about informally in terms of the politics? With the
politics, that was rough. That was rough. You see, at that time, one of the advantages, you know, just being young, and if you were articulate naturally, and if you had this burning desire, why, great, you know. And lots of times, I mean, we'd stick our necks out and know darn good and well we're being used, but if we believed in something, we just didn't care very much, we'd go along with the whole thing, you know. And I found that a lot of the women that were active that time, They were fighters. They really were. They'd get up there, they weren't afraid of the devil himself.
Mm-hmm.
They had to be that way in order to get where they were. Because we were having a hard time, you know, throughout the years being accepted by the men.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so we had to be clever. We had to be conniving. All kinds of things in order to get where we were.
Mm-hmm.
We had to be. And we gals used to exchange notes on that too, you know. Conditions down the South were different than they were out where we were, you know, and back in Detroit were different, and New York City were different,
mm-hmm.
and you know, but we'd compare notes. And to be on the bargaining committee was quite an honor.
When it, and at I was, the 51 convention, when you
I was in the bargaining committee then.
When you were talking with other women, were mm-hmm. other women in the same kind of position as you?
No. No, I didn't talk to anyone that was on the bargaining committee at that time. They were delegates to the convention, and that itself is really something to be elected to a delegate to a convention, a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of the men, and for years and years, you know, it's to go to the convention just a one big party, one big party thing. And to a lot of the guys, it still is.
Mm-hmm.
But to we gals, boy, it meant business. We had to be, you know, very serious. It was hard for us to get where we were. We wanted to attend business, and we wanted to do a good job. And to, you know, to bring good results back to our membership, and it's true, really. And, you know, I haven't changed much either. I always believed in working hard, but believe in playing hard. After we got our work done, that's fine, have a ball, you know. But I believed in getting that work done
mm-hmm.
and doing a good job for the membership. Now, I'm not saying that we haven't had problems with some of our gals that come in and they're political opportunists, such as we had not long ago on our Women's Committee here in Long Beach, and all those people are gone now.
Oh.
They all quit, went back to the Socialist Party, working with the Socialist Party. Anyway, then we've had some that they've embarrassed us because, you know, they like to go to these things to have a good time. And I used to, things like that used to embarrass me because I thought, gee whiz, you know, it's been so hard for us gals to get where we are. Doggone, I don't like to have any criticism brought down on us upon, you know, loose morals and that sort of thing. I'm never very happy about that sort of thing, and you know,
mm-hmm.
cropping up. And I think people in my own local knew that, and all the way up. So that's why I think they treated me like they did,
mm-hmm.
you know. And then, of course, too, you know, I was married to Ernie West, who was the president of the local there for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And so people knew how I felt about all these things. I didn't have any problem that way. But I really admired some of those gals, especially from down south. I tell you, they really had it rough. Their standard of living was so far below ours, you know. And to get recognition in your union down there, it was really tough.
Mm-hmm.
Much harder, I'm sure, than what I ever had to go through. Much harder.
Mm. Were there any black women at the
51
convention?
Mm-hmm.
And would they get together with the other women?
Oh, yes.
Or were they more likely to be with to talk
to the black men? Oh, no, we women got together. We sure did. We'd seek one another out.
Mm. Was that the basis for any kind of permanent ongoing communication?
No, not really. Not really, no. Not really. It was, you know.
So sort of each convention you'd
seek out to see who was there. That's right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And see how, you seek them out from these different locals, you know, and and then to see how they progressed in
mm-hmm.
the 3 years or 2 years, whatever it may be, and their contract gains and that sort of thing, you know. And it was really interesting. Now, of course, we don't do it that way. We see each other, and, Lord, we'll meet again in summer school. We'll meet again in Black Lake. We'll meet again in Detroit or
mm-hmm.
all around.